Heaven listening to that, and I'm even bigger heaven now because on the phone is the man himself, Greg Lake. Good afternoon, Greg.
Hi, Dennis. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you? You must be a bit tired because you've just come off a tour, haven't you? You've been very busy.
I'm a little bit tired, yeah, I must confess. But happy, very happy.
It was a great tour. I went to see you twice, so I wish I could have got to them all, but unfortunately I couldn't. And I've got to say to you now, Greg, that I've seen you, you know, on with your band now, and I've seen you with Emerson, Lake and Palmer going around the country, and I think I was more impressed this time than I was with the LP, and that was magnificent. But you've got such a good band with you, haven't you?
It is a wonderful group, yeah. They're just tremendous, tremendous band. And, of course, each one of the players is really a master in their own right.
I mean, they're quite a tight-knit band, and they produce some fantastic sounds. Now, from what I gather, having spoken to you and the band after the concerts, you didn't have that long to get it all together before you went on tour, did you?
It was quite quick, the preparation. We just had a couple of weeks' rehearsal, and basically we were into it.
But blimey, wasn't it good?
Yeah, well, they are the business, you know.
I mean, let's run through the musicians quickly. Have you worked with any of them before then, Greg?
Yes, all of them.
You have, in some form or other.
I've known most of them for some time, you know.
I mean, the young guy, the guitarist, whose name I can never pronounce.
Florian.
Florian,
that's
it, Florian. Mm. Is he German?
He's German, he's from Munich.
Yeah, from Munich. Now, that guy, I was so impressed with.
Yeah, he's world class and... will be a huge star, I'm sure.
I'm sure he will. Now, I sat back and I thought when I saw him, the last time I saw you on tour was your Black Moon tour in 93, and he'd only been 9 years old then, and I thought, my goodness.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, he started playing guitar when he was 5.
Yeah.
He's now 22. but he played classical guitar most of his life. And then in later years, branched out into electric.
Right.
And he's just sort of, with all the technique and everything he's got from the classical playing, he could handle the technique. So, it was just a question of listening and, all the electric guitar he played by ear, but all the classical stuff he read by music. So he lives in both worlds, which is very unusual.
And he's such a happy guy. To talk to him at the end of the shows, he really did get a buzz off that tour, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah, well, they're lovely people.
They all did. It was great. Right, let's sort of go into rewind now, Greg. How did it all start for you? I mean, you, as a young lad, you were in, is it Poole or Bournemouth? I always get mixed up.
I was born in Poole, really.
You were born in Poole. Mm. So, was it always your intention to be a musician?
Well, always from the age, I suppose, of 12.
Yeah.
Once I started to play the guitar, I very quickly became devoted to it. But before that time, I have to say, I had no inclination of music, really. I was just like every other kid, playing football, buggering around with bikes, but once I discovered the guitar, it became, obsessional almost with me. And I did, I did devote my entire life to it, and to that extent knew what I wanted to do.
Sure. Were your parents supportive? Because, I mean, most teenagers, if they want to go into a music career, the parents sort of say, yeah, all right, but get a proper job first.
I think it was a bit like that for me as well. My parents were very supportive because they knew how much I wanted to play guitar. But particularly my father was very aware that it was a tough world and that as a man you need to provide a living, and I think he was conscious of wanting to make sure that I had some sort of, profession in inverted commas to fall back on. I actually did for a little while. I started an apprenticeship as a draftsman.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to fall asleep at the drawing board because
you've been
I'd
playing
come
the
back from
before.
Gigs, at 4 and 5 in the morning. And go straight into work, and by 11 o'clock in the morning, I was falling asleep, and they said to me, look, you just got to make up your mind, what do you want to do? Do you want to do an apprenticeship in being a draftsman, or do you want to be a musician? And there just wasn't any choice.
Mm.
I just said, I've got to be a musician,
and that's
where it all ended, off I went, and I was a musician. From then on,
Really? Well, what was the first sort of public performance you did then? Well, how did it all come about?
Well, the first public performance I did was when I was very young, when I was 12, 13, and I started performing. The very first place I actually played was a bingo hall.
Yeah?
And I played there for nothing with a little band I had. And and I remember they used to pass a hat round,
mm-hmm.
and get some money, and that was the first time that I was in touch with the being able to earn money from playing music.
Great.
And it was a although it was a very humble beginning, it was a very instructive, you know, the whole thing of playing music and getting paid all tied up. And the adoration, you know, yeah. I mean, all the old ladies in the bingo hall would look up at these little boys. Oh, aren't they sweet? Look, you know.
what sort of material were you playing?
Ah, well, we would all play. We play stuff from the charts, then, yeah. You know. It'd be Cliff and the Shadows. Mm. And,
you're a great admirer, aren't you, Hank Marvin?
Well, I do admire Hank. I think he's great, and he just, you know, I took a lot of inspiration from him in the early days when I was a child, and. I've got a lot to be grateful to him for, really. But funny enough, most of the great guitar players that I ever met, Jimi Hendrix, Jeff Beck, Gary Moore, all of them, rather like me, you know, always had a soft spot for Hank, you know. We always just, you know, always loved his sound.
Have you had the opportunity to actually play with him?
I haven't actually played with him professionally, but I did go and see him a couple of years ago just to thank him, you know.
Yeah.
We spent an afternoon together in the studio, and, it, you know, it was just...
Oh, that must have been great for you. That must have been really great.
Yeah. The great moment was playing his Stratocaster.
Was it? Cool. A treasured possession of Hank Marvin's. Letting you ever go on there. Brilliant. Oh, I can imagine how you felt. Bit like me talking to you now, Greg, because I've admired you and of course, ELP in general for years, and it's just an honour to talk to you. Oh, does that sound like creeping?
not at all.
But I'm enjoying it. Mm. Right, Greg, now, you started to say, with a local band, when did it sort of turn to fully professional? How did that come about?
It's hard to put an actual point on it. But, you know, the first real success I had in terms of world success was King Crimson.
Yeah.
That's of course... For years and years prior to that, I was travelling around the country playing shows in you know, various bands.
There was a band called The Gods, if I recall right. Was
well,
right?
The Gods was another band, and that was one of those bands that sort of everybody played for.
Yeah.
Membership
changed weekly, did it?
It was like a bit like that. You know, it was one of those bands that, you know, you kind of joined and left. But yeah, there were a number of bands I formed and played with, and in and out, like kids do, you know, just people would leave and get jobs and you'd replace them and or you'd go leave and find another one. You know, so it was a kind of a mixture of things, really, as I was growing up.
And I presume it's like most musicians, whether they're professional or not, it all starts by going up and down the country and probably sleeping in the back of the van.
That is right, and that to me was the foundation of my career. That was the foundation of my skill. They have a term for it in the music business, and that is paying your dues. And I think that it's the one difference in the music business of today and the music business that I grew up in is that you paid your dues in my day. And you didn't get a record deal until you were good.
Well, it was like an apprenticeship, wasn't it?
You had to be good to get a record deal.
Yeah.
Nowadays, you have a hit record, and then if it's a hit, you then learn how to play. You know.
Yeah.
And they put you out live.
Backwards way on now,
isn't
it?
It's entirely backwards. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I don't think is too clever a way to go about it, because some people, quite frankly, just can't. You know, they're not very good.
Mm.
Yeah, the public are listening to people that are extremely manufactured and faked, quite frankly, in a lot of cases.
I tend to agree with you there. I think it works on looks and personality rather than talent sometimes, and I think it all boils down to books, doesn't it? If people can see that money can be made out of it, it doesn't matter if they've got talent or not.
I think it's become too visual.
Yeah.
Where music has become subordinate to appearance, and... So it just really, you know, looks are everything, and music is an incidental which can be smeared on and faked if necessary.
Mm.
The trouble is, it can't be faked when you're standing there in the flesh and have to deliver.
Of course.
Where bands like mine, you know, have a high degree of impact.
That's right, true
musicianship. Because when they stand in there in real time, it's very impressive to see someone who can really play.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, you've just reminded me of last Thursday at Chesterfield. You got held up, didn't you? You actually got held up getting to the venue.
We did. There was some appalling traffic.
Yeah, and you literally walked through the doors and went straight on stage.
Yeah, literally did.
Performed a phenomenal concert.
That's the state of the state of British roads for you.
But I mean, you know, that to me summed it up. You're just a professional musician. You got there, you did what needed doing, and you did it very well. And, you know, some of the newer generation, I don't think, could cope with that.
I don't know. I mean, to me, I've always felt an indebtedness to the public, especially in the United Kingdom. I mean, because it was they who made me successful. And it's a debt. It's almost a debt of honor. It's something I feel that I owe to the people who followed and supported me. So in a way, you know, it's not hard at all. It's not something I find difficult to do or... You know, I just find it natural. I'm just grateful. And every time I go out to play to an audience, it is a very warm, well, you were there, you saw it. It's a very warm feeling.
It's a very personal thing to you, isn't it?
Very personal, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the fans appreciate that as well, especially at the end. You do a meet and greet session, which really I thought was absolutely brilliant for the fans, because you've been an idol for a lot of people for a number of years, and maybe, I think, in the ELP days, maybe you may agree, maybe you don't, but it got so big that it distanced itself from the fans. But with the way you're doing it now, you chat to them as though they live next door to you, virtually, as friends.
Well, look, because I'd been away for so many years, there were so many people who I knew wanted to say something to me. You know, they've got stuff to tell you, you know. The last time I saw you was at Wembley, you know. And they just got stories to tell.
Yeah.
And I actually do enjoy listening to them. The only thing is, it does get a bit hard sometimes
because
so many people stay back after the show.
It gets tiring, yeah.
It adds another hour and a half to the show, really, and you're there for 3 or 4 hours doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So it does get a bit fatiguing, but I must say I did enjoy it, and I don't know whether I'll be able to keep doing it like that, but it certainly, for this one tour, it was a pleasure, and I'm glad, you know, I did it.
Yeah, I think you made it very memorable for a lot of the fans as well, because on your website they're talking about it, how good it was to be able to meet you, chat to you, and discuss things with you, which has been fantastic.
Yeah, well... That's the lovely thing, too, about the internet, that they can continue, and I do have a message board, and it's nice for people who want to get on and talk about it and discuss that experience and talk amongst themselves, because the interesting thing is, you know, like, people who like anything, I suppose, have something in common.
Mm.
And they share it, and
that's
they share
right.
it on this message board.
It's like a club, isn't it? Like a club.
Yeah, it's a family or a club.
Yeah, yeah, and they all enjoy it. There's
I mean, I had people that on this tour come from America, come from Tokyo, all that had met and talked on the message board.
That's right, and the friendliness. I mean, people were meeting each other. They'd never met face-to-face before.
Yeah.
Suddenly meeting each other at concerts, and it's as though they'd known each other for years personally.
Yeah,
really
yeah,
because
they talked on the message
That's
board.
That's right, yeah.
That's right, it's a remarkable thing.
Fantastic.
It is, in fact, a new phenomenon.
It is, and I think in this case, it's definitely worth its while. You know, it's something that people can get together and have a relationship, but that's a bit wrong probably, but have an actual bonding, a subject that bonds them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's get back to the music for a moment, and because otherwise we're going to run out of time. I could keep you going for 2 hours, Greg, but I know you're a tired man. Right, now, you say King Crimson really was your sort of start into the big time. That was with Robert Fripp. You actually started to learn guitar with Robert Fripp, didn't you? Weren't he a student at one of your guitar tutors?
Robert and I went to the same guitar teacher.
Right.
As did Andy Summers from Police.
Right. This was in Poole, was it?
It was in Westbourne, actually,
yeah.
Which is just the next town along the beach. And Robert and I grew up together. We went to the same guitar teacher, and we used to, after we'd been to our lessons, you know, we used to go around each other's house and sit there and practice together. So Bob and I really knew each other's guitar playing, inside out.
Yeah.
I knew exactly what he was playing, and he knew exactly what I was playing, because we'd both been taught the same stuff.
So a very close friendship all the way through, yeah.
So when we come to play in the same band together, you know, people didn't realize, actually, that we knew each other that well. We knew each other, had been playing together for years, really.
Yeah.
But it didn't look like that, you know, because by then I was on bass, not guitar.
Mm.
But I knew everything Robert was playing, and so we were very locked in, you know.
Sure, all the sort of practice sessions you'd had, you knew what he was going to do, he knew what you would do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so how did the King Crimson phenomenon start? Was that, you know, were you having to badger record companies, or did somebody discover you?
It was, I can only say, put it to you, that it was a phenomenon. It really didn't need any promotion or anything, really. It was self-perpetuating. And, you know, every day would bring about this new wave of energy and you know, things would just materialize. I mean, we would play, 1 week we'd be playing to 200 people, the next week it was 400, the next week it was 800, the next week it was 2,000, you know, that's how it went.
It just grew.
It just grew, but it grew like wildfire.
And we're talking about, what, 1969? 70?
Yeah, 69, yeah. Really, was the year. And, you know, the record company was all, everything was in place.
I mean,
it was one of those things that was just, it almost was fatalistic, you know.
The music scene at that time, of course, there was so many good musicians about, weren't there? And what I call the progressive side of music took centre stage rather than just the chart stuff, of which a lot of people are focused on nowadays. But there was such an input in music from loads of bands. It must have been a fantastic era to be in.
Well, it was, and as you rightly say, that, you know, the thing was, every band had its own identity. You would know within seconds if you were listening to, if you put on a CD and you were blindfolded, you would know within 3 seconds who it was. If it was Jimi Hendrix, you could tell within 3 seconds of starting the record, because the identity was so strong. The Pink Floyd, you would know immediately. The Who, ELP. These bands all had such a strong personality and such an identifiable and original sound that you would know immediately. Unlike today, you put a CD on today, you wouldn't know who it is, probably even when the record's finished, unless someone told you.
Yeah. Yeah, because I understand what you're saying. It's an individual sound to each one, and it's a piece of magic to listen to some of the stuff, even nowadays, going through the old times. But then again, I'm getting on a bit. saying that, there's a lot of younger people now getting into that, which I'm very pleased about. In fact, at your concert the other night, I was very pleased to see a mixture of age groups, to see younger people. In fact, a young girl by the name of Jennifer, 9 years old, she's asked me to say hello to you again, Greg, because you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny, but you do see, you know, occasionally, very, very young people, because they come along with their parents, you know. But also, you know, there are some people who, you know, it's strange because fans of ELP are people like, for instance, I'll give you an example, the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yeah.
Are big fans of ELP. People wouldn't know that, but it was like when I grew up, I was influenced by people like Little Richard and Elvis, I suppose, and people like that. But, you know, everybody's influenced by somebody.
That's right.
You know, everybody's got influences. And I suppose groups like ELP, in their turn, influenced the younger generation.
And music is also like a diary, isn't it? You can place yourself somewhere when you hear a piece of music.
Yeah, your life really, everyone's life has musical markers. You know, you identify moments in your life unconsciously most of the time, but with music.
That's right.
It tends to impregnate itself along with the memories or events in your life.
Are there any markers in your life that you can pin to pieces of music?
Well, yeah, but probably more than most people.
Yeah, because
I'm a musician.
Of course.
It would be a job to point out, oh, I would, you know, this moment, that moment, and often you can't tie the exact moment to the concert, although some people do, some people can, but it tends to be a sort of period in your life.
Yeah.
You know, you'll hear a song and it evokes the memories of a certain time in your youth, or, you know, a relationship often will be marked by music.
And it stays there forever, doesn't it? Brilliant.
Mm. Yeah, it does. It's a very powerful thing, music. And you know, the reason for that is it is a remarkable thing. It travels through the air, invisible, and enters your body, you know. You can't stop it.
That's right.
Yeah. And
thank goodness you can't, to be honest, I think.
And it affects the emotions.
Yeah.
And it comes through the air invisibly. So it's a pretty remarkable thing, really.
It is. It's a language of its own, isn't it? It's a feeling rather than just a sound. Now, King Crimson didn't last that long, really, did you? Because,
yeah.
like a lot of times, and I should imagine things were like that for you, people want to go their own way, have their own ideas. So was that how Crimson really came to an end?
It came to an end because two of the boys in the band really didn't enjoy the flying very much, and life on the road. They really didn't like the hectic, crazy nature of touring America, really.
Right.
And they decided they wanted to stay more in the studio and just make albums in the studio. And it was two of the people in the band. I just felt it wasn't honest to continue the band and just replace them and call it the same name. And that was when I left and formed ELP.
Right, we're talking of, what was it, Ian MacDonald? And
yeah, the guys that left were Ian MacDonald and Mike Giles.
Yeah. So that sort of one thing came to an end. Was the timing just about perfect for ELP? Or did you wonder what was going to come next?
When it finished, I had no idea what was going to come next. But coincidentally, on the night it actually ended, we were playing a show at the Fillmore West in San Francisco, venue run then by the late Bill Graham. And on the bill, coincidentally, was the Nice.
Keith Emerson's band.
Yeah.
Yes.
And after the show, you know, I got together with Keith in the hotel. We're just in the bar there talking, you know, because we were both British guys and in abroad, you know. And I asked, you know, how you doing? And he said, oh, fine, you know, how are you doing? And I said, well, okay, you know, a bit sad, really, because, you know, the band's just split up and I'm thinking of, you know, what I'm going to do next. And Keith said, well, he said, to be honest, I've reached the end, really, with the Nice. I've taken it as far as I can go, you know. And so we decided to form a band.
And that's how it was?
And then we didn't have a drummer at that stage. Mm. We went back to England and eventually found Carl.
And Carl Palmer. Now, there was a rumour, maybe you can clarify this. Was there almost a chance that Jimi Hendrix was going to join with you?
One of the drummers we talked to was Mitch Mitchell.
From Jimi Hendrix experience.
From Jimi Hendrix. Yeah. And it was a plan that we were going to get together with Jimi and we were going to have a play together to see, you know, to see if it would work out. But it didn't happen. At some point after that, Jimi was found dead. He died from an overdose, and that was the end of that, really.
I mean, do you regret that? Because do you think that would have been such a phenomenal experience, the yourself, Carl Palmer, and of course Keith Emerson, along with Jimi Hendrix, that would have I think it would have been
on paper.
Whether it would have worked or not,
or not is another thing. It's a strange thing. Musical is a strange chemistry.
Sure.
And too much of something, for instance, can produce nothing.
Mm. I can imagine. You never know until you try.
Having everything, the right amount of things, which is important. So as much as, I mean, I love Jimi, of course, you know. But I think that perhaps Keith and Jimi together might have just been too much you know, to work well. I don't know.
Yeah, both showmen in their own right, aren't they?
Yeah.
So, I can see what you're saying. I mean, ELP dominated the progressive, well, the album charts and the field of progressive music right up to the, well, late 70s, I would imagine, and through to the 80s. But you toured so much, didn't you? Big venues. That must have really been a strain, I would imagine, when you're doing 60 gigs on a tour. I shouldn't think you knew which city we were in sometimes.
I mean, right throughout the 70s, we worked too much, really. You know, we were working almost every day that God sent, and as a three-piece band, I think we reached the end of exhausting all the possibilities we had. Certainly, that combined with working too intensely dried the thing up.
Mm. I mean, I should imagine the stresses of just touring, and also musically. I mean, was there a set pattern that you had for the compositions that you've produced? You know, did you usually come with an idea? Did Keith, or was it? You know, did you actually all get together, or did you do a lot of it on your own?
All of the above, really. Mm. I mean, I have to say that a lot of it was done, for want of a better word, on the fly in the studio. No. I produced the records. Keith would come in with some music. I would invariably write a song to accompany that music. And then I would set about producing the record itself, of knitting it all together in
sure.
a way.
You did most of the production, did you, on most albums?
On the early albums,
on the early ones, yeah. And did you feel that at times, I mean, like a lot of bands, you know, there were problems and people had their own opinions. Did you feel, as time went on, that it was getting harder to keep it together?
Egos began to play too much a part in the band.
Yeah.
And it became too much to do with ego and too little to do with
music.
Being a band and of musicians together. And in the end, that the ego swamped the creativity, I think.
Yeah.
And the band drowned in the pool of its own success, really.
And that was towards the end of the 70s, wasn't it? 79, I think, was it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you did a tour in 79, and then you did some solo stuff after that, didn't you? Gary
Moore. I formed a band after that, actually, with Gary Moore.
From Thursday.
Yes. And it was a great band, but I think it didn't have a defined sort of musical direction, and I was so, I don't know what the right word was, but I was stunned in a way by a decade of absolute, you know, madness, really.
Yeah.
And greatness, but at the end of it all, I just needed to stop. And instead of stopping, I went on.
You worked yourself too
hard. I went straight into a solo career,
yeah.
And I really did it without having a break or without thinking about, you know, adjusting to a new reality. The pressure was put upon me, really, by record companies to deliver. You know, they didn't, you know, all this income coming from ELP, they wanted to recreate it, and you know, I was forced, really, into moving too quickly.
Sure.
But it was a great band, and you know, a lot of good came from it. I still play with Gary to this day, you know. We're good friends, and we play together, but the band itself really wasn't that much of a success. And
well, you've worked alongside a lot of famous musicians, haven't you? Ringo Starr, for example.
I toured with Ringo a couple of years ago, which was great. A lot of fun. He was a good, you know, he just is great, Ringo. And it was a great band we had. Sheila E., who plays for Prince.
Yeah.
Howard Jones was on keyboards.
Brilliant.
Roger Hodgson from Supertramp.
Great.
Ian Hunter, Mott the Hoople.
Yeah, some great
names. It was a great band. It was just a great band. And I also recorded with The Who. I did their last single.
Brilliant.
I do quite a lot of charity work, actually, with Roger.
Yeah.
We're involved in this Teenage Cancer Trust.
Mm-hmm.
We do a lot for that. And, well, Roger does. I mean, I play in the band. This year I'm going to do a standalone concert for them at the Albert Hall.
Oh, that sounds nice. I mean, venues like that, that must bring back some bright memories originally, but the feel of it, the feel of the Albert Hall and some of the mega venues that you've played around the world, I've often sat back and thought, what's it like to be up on a stage to see that many people? It must be frightening, but great at the same time.
You do develop a kind of immunity to it. You know, when the first couple of times you go out, it is a shock, you know. But then you kind of get used to it.
You get that mindset where you're into the music and you've got a job to do.
It's actually, when you go out into an 80,000 seat stadium, for example, it is like looking out at the sea, you know. You lose the sense of it all being individual people. Mm. It's almost like a colour, it's almost like a texture.
Yeah. I can imagine that.
And yeah. you don't really become nervous.
Sure.
You know, it's beyond that, really.
Sure. I should imagine that being a rock musician, going around the world, goodness knows how many times, and all these concerts, you've got to have some solid, good friendships that stick with you to help you keep your feet on the ground. Because I should imagine you can go down different tracks and get waylaid. I mean, you're a married man. You must have a really solid wife who's helped you through your career and kept your feet on the ground for you.
Yes, I do. But I think that ultimately you have to realise that other people's perception of you, right, either good or bad, is not necessarily what you are.
Sure.
It is what they may like you to be, may fantasize about you being. But, you know, the moment you start believing in yourself as a star, I mean, it's the rocky road to disaster, really. Because, you know, I mean, I've long since learnt, you know, to take adoration with a pinch of salt, as I do indeed take criticism with a pinch of salt. I'll listen to it, but I won't let it bother me.
Sure.
Because, you know, and I don't get excited or too puffed up when people say, oh, Greg, you know, you're awesome, man, blah, blah, blah. You know, because it's nice, but the thing is you know, get over it, because, you know, tomorrow you've got to prove it all again.
I say, tomorrow's another day.
Yes.
Yeah, you've got to start again.
What do they say? You're only as good as your last hit record.
That's right. Greg, it's it really is a pleasure talking to you. I'm going to, before we wind up, I'm going to play a little bit of music because this I'm sure, well, you'll know, it means something to you because behind the scenes you've been working quite hard for missing children, haven't you? The plight of missing children, and you recorded a song called Daddy, which has a lot of relevance to that subject. I'm just going to play a little bit and then fade it down. We'll talk a little bit about that before we wind it up, Greg.
Yeah.
If that's okay with you.
Yep.
To me, she means the world.
I'd like to play it in its entirety, but time's running out. We'll just let it play while we talk, Greg. What's the story behind that?
It was when I lived in Los Angeles for a while, I was watching a program called America's Most Wanted, and a story came on about a girl that had been abducted and murdered. And it was actually a film about her father, who was searching for a missing body. And he was in the middle of winter in the Adirondacks in upstate New York, in the snow, with a bunch of volunteers that had joined him, looking for a body, you know. And they went to interview him, really, and they said, you know, like, how do you manage to keep going under these conditions? And he said, I can hear her calling to me. And she's saying, Daddy, come and bring me home.
Oh, sad.
And it hit me so hard, you know. I've got a daughter of my own. And I just thought, my Christ, I mean, how must that feel to be digging in the snow in the middle of winter trying to look for your child's body? You know, and they caught the murderer. They caught the man who'd done the murder, but he refused to say where he buried the body. And anyway, I met this man in the end who'd lost his daughter. And I'd written this song, you know, in a way to sort of deal with the feeling of it, the grief of it, you know. And I donated the royalties to a fund he'd set up, which has now become the Orange Alert system, so that when a kid goes missing in America, within minutes, literally, they've started to post the picture in every petrol station, in every post office, in every supermarket. It goes up, and within an hour, everywhere in America has got the kid's picture up.
Oh, that's great. Good.
And the fact of the matter is that the best chance you've got of recovering a child, a missing child, is within the first hour.
Yeah.
After that, the graph drops off very steeply. So, you know, the thing is the quicker you move, the more chance you've got of recovery. And since this Orange Alert has been up and running, the amount of recoveries have increased dramatically, you know.
Oh, that's good.
So that was a good thing to do, and that is how I got involved in it.
And I think behind the scenes you've got passion, because you mentioned on stage as well. I mean, I've got to move on very quickly because we're running out of time, Greg. I say we're going to have to book you for about 3 hours next time. You mentioned on your concert tour when you played a track, Farewell to Arms. Unfortunately, I haven't got time to play it, but you mentioned there your thoughts about the arms struggle the struggle in Iraq, and you dedicated the song Farewell to Arms. You sound a very passionate person on subjects like that, especially.
Well, we all are. We all are passionate people. The thing is, I'm a musician, and so therefore, it's the way you can express it, really.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that was both those songs you've just mentioned, the one you just played, and Farewell to Arms, are both things that I feel strongly about.
And you have the ideal opportunity to actually put your voice.
Well, as I said, that's what a musician does or is supposed to do, and I think that's the difference between the music, you know, when I was started, and the music today. I don't hear a lot of passion being expressed today.
Well, long may it continue, Greg.
Good, well.
Long
good.
May it continue with you. When will we be able to see you again touring?
Well, I play in the States. I'm doing a tour in the States in March and April. And I think I'm playing another UK tour, I believe it's June.
Right, we'll look forward to that.
This coming June.
Yeah. Is that going to be similar to the tour you've just done? Are you going to do bigger or smaller venues?
It'll be bigger venues,
yeah.
And it'll be the same band.
Brilliant.
But a bigger production.
Bigger still. I'm looking forward to it. Okay. Mind you, if you want to practice, Greg, come down to Grantham in Lincolnshire. We've got a leisure centre that'll hold 1,400 people. If you just want to get it off the ground.
Yeah, that's where to go, right?
That's it. That's what I want. I want to see you in a small town.
It's a beautiful thing.
Do you know, little towns, unfortunately, never get the chance to see great people like yourself because of the finances of everything. You know, we can't get the big artists down
right,
there.
Right, right.
But one day. Greg, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Pleasure talking to you as well.
Thank you. I'll make a Parkinson yet, I think, if I work hard enough at it.
Right.
Greg, just before we go, and you said this on the tour about the Father Christmas. It's a classic now. Did you know it was going to be a classic? Had you a feeling it might go that way?
No.
But it's,
I had no idea whatsoever.
No.
It was designed as an album track, and the rest of what happened to it was really fate, you know. It just got picked up as a single. It then became a hit, and then it became something that people put on every compilation known to man, you know.
Yeah, but it's still a classic, and it's a great song. And we're going to finish off with it, Greg. Even though it's a bit early, I wish you a Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, yeah, bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Greg, for being my guest. It's been an honour to talk to you.
Okay,
thank
bye-bye.
Thank you,
then.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
They said there'll be snow at Christmas. They said there'll be peace on earth. But instead it just kept on raining, a veil of tears for the virgin birth. I remember one Christmas morning, a winter's light and a distant choir, and the peal of a bell and that Christmas tree smell, and eyes full of tinsel and fire. Dream of Christmas. They sold me a silent night. They told me a fairy story.
Well, that was my Christmas present.
Believed in the
my hero Greg Lake of Emerson, Lake and Palmer. Hope you enjoyed the chat. Time's up for me. Dennis Kay saying goodbye, and I look forward to your company next week. It's news time.